Fishing like a local isn't just about catching fish. It's about connecting with the environment and the people who call it home. It's about hearing the stories and traditions that have been passed down for generations and sharing unforgettable moments with the people you meet along the way. Fishing like a local is having an experience that stays with you forever. And with Fishing Booker, you can experience it too, no matter where you are. Discover your next adventure on Fishing Booker.
This upcoming concert season will be all about the boots, and Tecovas is your stop for the best in Western style. Tecovas has seasonal and limited edition offerings this spring and summer, including men's and women's boots, apparel, hats, bags, and more. All Tecovas boots are made by hand in a time-honored tradition with timeless styles that are always on trend. And Tecovas has first wear comfort with little to no break-in period. It's hard to find this level of comfort paired with this level of style. Stop by your local Tecovas store, have a complimentary drink or two, that's WCB style, and shop new styles. The smell of fresh leather and friendly staff are at your service. Many stores even have leather custom branding to make your boots truly personalized. And with regular live music and events, there's no in-store experience like it. If you can't make it into a store, just visit Tecovas.com. That's Tecovas.com. They offer free shipping on all boots, as well as free returns and exchanges, and ship right to your door. Go to Tecovas.com and find your new favorite pair of boots today.
Your brain needs support, and new Ollie Brainy Chews are a delightful way to take care of your cognitive health. Made with scientifically backed ingredients like Thai ginger, L-theanine, and caffeine, Brainy Chews support healthy brain function and help you find your focus, stay chill, or get energized. Be kind to your mind and get these nootropic chews at Ollie.com. That's Olly.com. These statements have not been evaluated by the Food and Drug Administration. This product is not intended to diagnose, treat, cure, or prevent any disease.
It felt really incredible, but at the same time for me it was all just about getting to the gate, and everything in me was screaming, stop, you need to breathe. And I was just like overriding all those signals and almost telling my body, if you can't run this pace, then run faster. So I was like, just sprint and you'll get there faster. And all the time in the back of my mind was this idea at that point that you might finish seconds over and it'd be like a Gary Robbins story again and you'll have to do it all over again.
I'm Doc and this is Hiker Trash Radio.
Hey, is this thing on? Hello? Hit it again. I think it's on now. Welcome to Hiker Trash Radio, where each week, Doc will drag some colorful characters out of the woods to talk trail and type 2 fun. If you're aspiring hiker trash, or if you're just looking to understand the hiker trash in your life, look no further. So lace up those boots, gnaw on some jerky, and settle into your 20-mile pace as we fire up the podcast from somewhere deep in the backcountry. It's time to embrace the suck.
We are stoked to partner with Garage Grown Gear on this episode of Hiker Trash Radio. Garage Grown Gear, or GGG for short, is your online store for all things ultralight backpacking. Dedicated to supporting the growth of small and cottage brands, they've got everything you need all in one place. From ultralight accessories to dehydrated meals to your big three, Garage Grown Gear has everything you need to lighten your load. Based out of St. Paul, Minnesota, GGG is known for its commitment to providing quality ultralight gear, stellar customer service, and free shipping and returns over $40.
Welcome back to another week on the trail, Dirtbags, Hiker Trash, and of course, those good-smelling day hikers. I'm Doc, and this is Hiker Trash Radio. Hey, if you like what we're doing here, help us out. Take just a minute, leave us a review on Apple Podcasts. And if you don't like what we're doing, well, just go ahead and keep that to yourself. All right. Hey, we have a very special episode for you this week. Last month, one of the most incredible finishes took place in what is perhaps the toughest ultra in the world. With the slimmest of margins, Jasmine Paris became the first woman to complete the Barkley Marathons, and she is joining us today to share her experience. Welcome to Hiker Trash Radio, Jasmine. How's it going?
Hello. Thanks for having me.
Absolutely. Now, have you listened to the podcast at all?
No, I've not had time, I'm afraid.
I didn't think so. I love talking to people who have no idea what they're getting themselves into. So just buckle up. We're going to have a lot of fun. Here we go. Now, Jasmine, I talked to Jared Campbell last week about this year's Barkley, and he described the race as a filtration system for humanity. You take everybody in the world, you have those people that are interested who aren't interested, you have those people that want to race it, who don't want to race it, they go through the application process, they end up on the course, chews them up, spits them out. What are we left with? What does the Barkley filter out for us? Who are the people out there?
I thought the people that I share the miles out there with, especially in the later loops, were fantastic people. I think that you have to be super determined to get to those later loops. You have to have an understanding of the of kind of wild places and, yeah, and the kind of real desire to achieve what you're aiming for. And somehow, I guess, you have to be prepared to be self-sufficient, able to cope with the with a complete lack of civilization. It kind of strips back everything. You get down to the kind of very simple things of trying to move through a landscape that's really challenging with just what you've got on your back and with what you've got in your head. So all that kind of usual support network that you might have with doing trail races with lots of aid stations and so on, it's not like that at all. And I think it just distills the best in people, like working together with people, on the people that I ran with on loop three and then loop four with Jared and Greg. And I think we had fantastic times out there, got very fond memories, and it was good to share those miles with those people. And yeah.
Yes, Eeyore Varies said that the race is designed for smart people. You look at the people who have finished out there and who have done very well, and these are people from like academia and have very good head on their shoulders. You can't just show up to this race without doing any research or homework.
Yeah, I think it's both things, maybe the preparation beforehand, but also the ability to problem solve. I think that's a massive thing at this race, because you don't, especially when you go there the first time, you have no idea what you're getting into. But then even if you've been there multiple times before, it still throws things at you that you weren't expecting. You still get lost in a new place every time. And you have to just be able to work your way out of that situation. So I think that ability to think logically and work your way through a problem is a huge asset of that race.
Okay. Hey, before we get too far down the trail at Frozen Head, let's back up just a little bit. We'd love to hear about your background and where you grew up, and how in the world did you get involved in the ultra running cult?
Yeah, so I grew up in the Peak District in the UK in England, and I'm half Czech, so I grew up partly there as well, in the countryside in the Czech Republic, in the mountains there. So very lucky, had pretty idyllic childhood, spent lots of time outside, summer holidays with barefoot for 2 months running around in the forest type of thing. My parents did a lot of hiking from a really early age, and then when I was a teenager and in my early 20s, I did a lot of hiking with my brother in mountains all across Europe. And actually really good preparation for Barkley, because a lot of time spent in pretty remote mountains. Yeah, the aim was always not to see anybody really. So we'd take stuff that we needed for maybe 7, maybe even 10 days and start with really heavy rucksacks and eat our way through them. But those, the adventures we had then, when we were often a bit naive of the situations we got ourselves into. But again, that problem solving and that sort of, yeah, understanding of the natural world and the weather patterns and things like that, that all came there. And lots of times actually found ourselves like bashing through undergrowth when paths didn't exist and that sort of thing. The maps in these places weren't always that great. So great grounding for Barkley. And then once I started working as a vet in my first job in a local town, a colleague suggested I go along to a local fell race, which is very kind of unique sport, I think, in the UK, really. So running across the hills, but navigating your way across them. And lots of our hills here in the UK don't have forest on, so it's very doable. And they're not particularly precipitous cliffs or anything. So it's a particular sport here. It's very traditional. So I started being a fell runner and naturally liked doing longer things more and rougher things. I just found I was better at moving across rough terrain than other people, and just enjoyed spending a long time outside and meeting people, having time to eat. So I just gravitated towards longer, rougher races, and then gradually ended up at Barclay, I guess.
Just gradually ended up at the Barclay. Now, what was your first awareness that the Barclay existed? And when was the moment you thought this would be a good idea to participate in something like this?
I can't tell you when I first heard of Barclay. I almost feel like it's just something that's there almost from the moment that you start running and being interested in that it's just in the background there. I feel like I've always known about it. But I can say that when I first heard about it, I was a bit dubious about the idea of running laps in a forest and running the same loop twice. The irony is that you never actually run the same way twice. And that's what I think is the ironic thing about it. So, yeah, I can tell you when I changed my mind and suddenly realized that I wanted to do it, though. That was my second child must have been about 9 months old or so. And just one day I suddenly had this realization that I wanted to go and see whether I was capable of doing a finishing Barclay. And I think I'd heard about it from people after that I finished the Spine race, when I think Laz was interviewed at one point and somebody asked him whether he'd like me to, you know, how he might think I would do there. And he suggested that he would be keen to see me try. And people fed that back to me. And I think that was what planted the seed. And it grew. And then, as I say, when my son was born a bit after that, I suddenly realized that I wanted to give it a go.
That seems a little bit like a pressure situation. Laz says, I would like to see how she would do out there. Then you almost feel like you have to apply, right?
Oh, I don't feel particularly pressure. I definitely think it was a factor in me, the race coming to the foreground of my awareness. Yeah, it changed. It made it a kind of more clear option in my mind. And I also felt that I might have a chance of getting in if I could work out a way to how to apply. That if he had given indication that he would like to see me try, then hopefully he wouldn't reject me on the first kind of attempt again.
Yeah, very secretive application process. Would you care to lay out for our listeners the exact method by which someone is to apply?
No.
That's what I thought the answer would be. That's what the answer has always been. Yeah, nobody wants to share. But we have had folks say that if you are really interested, there are some clues out there on the internet that you can follow those breadcrumbs to the application process. All right. How many attempts at the Barclay for you so far?
This was my third attempt, so third time lucky, yeah.
And how did your strategy going into each one of those three, did they change each time once you learned about the course?
Yeah, you just mentioned one thing. I learned about the course. So each year I did, the first 2 years I was there, I did loops on my own. And that was a huge factor in terms of my confidence. I just felt more confidence in the park. It didn't feel as big and scary anymore, even that being out there on my own. I just felt more like I knew where I was going, largely because I made a lot of the mistakes already in the first 2 years that I'd been there. And this year I was more able to recognize that I was about to make a mistake, or recognize that I already had made a mistake and correct it before it became too much of a disaster. And I guess the kind of thing that changed a little bit that I could influence was that I did probably more ascent in my training this year. So I was doing some double sessions I'd do my standard training run with quite a lot of ascent, and then maybe do a stair climber session in the evening as well. So I was doubling up and generally doing a lot of hill reps, running up the same hill up and down multiple times. So yeah, that's probably the things I did. And actually, I'd had this sort of lingering slight tiredness in the last couple of years. And last summer, summer autumn, I dropped out of the Tour de Gion, and before running it, I never went. And that was largely I just wanted to get really back to feeling amazing again. And in my mind, part of that was because I wanted to go back to Barclay. And I thought, there's no point in going back unless you can be on the very top form. So I said last year when I came back, I was like, I think I can do it, but I need to be on top form. I need to be feeling good to go there and try again. Yeah, in some ways, last year's Tour de Gion was sacrificed for this year's Barclay, but I'm going to the Tour de Gion this year instead, so that'll be good.
I think that was a very smart decision by you. The Barclay is something that is just at the outer reaches of human accomplishment. It's so difficult that most years nobody finishes five loops, and so you have to be at the top of your game. When you're training for the Barclay, do you have a target elevation gain in terms of ascent that you look for prior to getting there?
I guess I was just trying to do as much as I could. And the challenge is obviously working full time with small children and trying to get the hours in. I think the biggest weeks I did somewhere between 11 and 12,000 meters of ascent in my biggest weeks of training. which for someone that runs full time might not seem that much. For me, that's quite a lot in 1 week. And I guess, yeah, I would just be doing, my longest runs tend to be about maybe 25 miles. So it was more just a case of finding a hill that was fairly steep and running up and down it for that kind of distance. So that was roughly what I did. So I think the longest ones were maybe just a bit under 5,000 meters, somewhere between 4,000 and 5,000 meters.
Sounds a lot like Sisyphus. pushing that rock up the hill and the rock coming going down to the bottom and doing it again. Just repeated torture. Okay. Now you said you have a day job. Are you a vet?
I'm a vet. Yeah, I'm a small animal vet. So I do some clinical work. I work for the university, actually, as sort of kind of referral hospital. And so teaching students and a kind of junior specialist and just working it on, as a kind of on the clinic floor. And then I also do some research, and that's looking at human liver disease.
Fantastic. Now let's talk a little bit before we get to this year's race. Let's talk about last year's race. You made it to the fifth loop. Quite an accomplishment. What happened out there on the fifth loop?
Oh no, last year I made it to the fourth loop and didn't make it to the fifth loop. In terms of what happened out there last year, I think when I set off on the fourth loop last year, I had not that much time. I had maybe 12 and a bit hours, and I knew it was going to be probably impossible to do, but I went at it and gave it my best shot. And I actually did finish that loop, and I got back to the gate, but it was like several hours over. And I still felt proud because in my head I'd done four loops, and it was good to have that extra time on the course and that experience. But from Laz's point of view, he was still like, you've done three loops, you didn't do four. He didn't even want to see my pages. But he did too. He did ask me whether I thought I could still do it. And I was like, yeah, I think I can do it. So yeah, that was last year. This year, I actually had quite a lot more time when I went out for that fourth loop. So I had enough time to try and do both four and five.
Laz is an interesting guy. He seems to be a bit of a curmudgeon, but I've also heard that he is sharp as a tack. He is very, very smart. How would you describe Laz Lake?
Yeah, I really like Laz. I have a lot of respect for him. I think he's very smart. I think he's like a genius in what he's created. And I think he's very funny. Yeah, I feel very fond of him. And it's wonderful he's given us a chance to test ourselves. It's a really unique event. It's hard to grasp that without going there. It's also hard to grasp quite how intimate and friendly the race is. There's a reason that people talk about this Barclay family. It's very nice.
Yes. Now, okay, let's go to this year's Barclay. You've got two prior experiences under your belt. How do you approach this year's race? Take us through your strategy for loops 1 through 4.
I did have a different approach this year in the sense that I knew if I wanted to finish 4 and 5, I needed to have more time going out for 4. So in my head, I think I wrote something in this year to Laz. I said, the first year I did a fun run in 40 hours. The second year I did it in 36. I said, by that pattern, I should do this year in 32. And that should give me 28 hours to do the last two loops. And actually, that's not far off. That's pretty much what I did. And the way that was made possible was I was determined to try and stick with people as more in those first loops so that I was doing less of the navigation on my own. And it's just easier moving as a group for lots of reasons. You know, you tend to pull out the pages of the book together and you keep each other right. So when something goes wrong, someone picks up on it. And it's just better for morale and encouraging you on the bad bits. So for all those reasons, I wanted to be with people. So I did actually manage to firstly run with people, and I realized that the people I was with were not going quite fast enough. So I tried to cross over to the group of John Kelly and didn't quite hang on. But actually on loop 2, I went out pretty strong and I managed to catch them up, much to my surprise, going up to the kind of fire tower, and then hung with them, stuck with them for loop 2 and most of loop 3. So by the time I finished loop 3, yeah, I'd achieved that goal of fairly fast first three loops. The challenge then was whether I'd broken myself too much to head out and finish the final two, really, because I'd struggled to eat quite a lot in loop 3 and I felt really pretty rough. I was coughing a lot. I wasn't able to eat very much. And sitting there before going out onto loop 4, I think there's pictures of me with my head in my hand because I really felt awful. I really wanted to stop at the same time, but there was absolutely no question that I was going to carry on. I was absolutely going to carry on. I knew in my head that there was no way that me was going to allow myself to stop because I was so determined to get this thing done. And especially given that I had all this time to try and make it possible. So I headed out again. And actually then it started to feel better. And then Jared and Greg caught me and I managed to hang on to them. like actively said to them, if you're all right with it, I'm going to try and hold on to you for as long as possible. And yeah, it was so nice to be with them. And then they dropped me, they pushed on right at the end of the loop and I couldn't hang on because I was again feeling pretty awful, but somehow managed to make it back into camp. And then loop five was just fueled by adrenaline, a kind of desperate desire to get back and get the whole thing done.
Now, let's talk about a couple of things. You're running this large circle in the woods and you have to finish it within 60 hours. I think a lot of people, it does not dawn to them that after the first three loops, the level of sleep deprivation and having to make decisions out there, that has got to be tremendously difficult. How did you handle the sleep deprivation?
Yeah, interestingly, that was less of an issue for me this year than it has been in previous years, maybe because I started less tired. I think what helped me on the final loop was that this massive adrenaline. As I say, I didn't really eat very much even. I just think that's what kept me going. But yeah, you start to hallucinate a bit. I think that happens for most things that you do when you don't sleep for a couple of nights. You start to hallucinate and see, I always see animals. I saw lots of people in black Macintoshes and raincoats on the kind of ridge above me this year, which I found very confusing the first time it happened because I really believed it. And then after that, it's probably going to be a hallucination. In terms of how you cope with it, I had caffeine gum, that kind of helps me to some extent. Obviously drank tea and, well, coffee and Coke in the camp. But as I say, the main thing that helped me this year was actually that kind of massive adrenaline rush, that kind of, I was riding this wave to get to the end, really.
Yeah, and I think it's also a special skill to, when your body is saying, I don't want to do this, I want to stop, I want to just give up, that you're able to push on. I think in most people, when their body tells them stop, people stop. Even before their body tells them to stop, people stop. And so to have that ability to push on past what you think you're limited is a really powerful skill to have out there.
Yeah, absolutely. And actually, that's one, I guess, that's definitely a part of the reason that I do these things. Because there's a kind of, and you come away from it feeling more confident and stronger. And this kind of, yeah, this wave of sort of, that carries you through life as well, going forwards, knowing where you managed to reach, what you managed to reach for at those moments.
Okay, let's talk about loop five. The finish was an incredible moment, but take us through loop five. I know you and Jared Campbell were getting ready to start that loop at the same time, and you chose to go clockwise. How did it go on the loop?
He gave me the option, really, to go clockwise because he was ready to go, and he came to the gate, and everybody knows it's a bit easier to go clockwise. Just you do the same ascent, but it's just the climbs are easier. And it was so him to offer me that option of going clockwise, and it definitely made the difference, I think, between finishing and not. So forever grateful to him for that.
Kind of indicative is what we were talking about before, about the quality of people out there and the type of people out there and the community.
Yeah, exactly. That's the community, and that's why we do it, isn't it? That's what we do it for. That's why you can't. It's really difficult to replace that sort of experience and this time with these sorts of people in any other way in life, I think. So really special things to think about and look back on. Yeah, so with that kind of massive boost, not only I knew I actually had a chance, but also like a morale boost of that kind of gesture, that option, that offer to me from Jared. I set off up the first climb, eating my banana, which I did manage to keep down. And basically, I was talking to myself. I was like, come on, you can do this. And this is it now. This is just one more loop. And yeah, I was talking to myself quite a lot. And I managed to hold it together and get the nav fairly right and not perfect. I made one kind of significant error, which cost me maybe 15, 20 minutes on that final loop, which I think John Kelly made a similar error at one point as well in that place. Yeah, that was the big problem, because if I had those 20 minutes, it wouldn't be quite so close at the end. But it wasn't it was basically when I passed John Kelly coming the other way and Greg and Jared. It was lovely to see them and they cheered me on. But I think afterwards they were, or maybe at the time, were thinking she's going to be really tight. I don't think she's going to make it. But I didn't know that. What I did know was that in my head, I still believed it was possible, but I knew it was going to be down to the wire. So I started calculating splits, and I was telling myself, basically, you need to be running as fast as you were on loop one. So you need to not run with a limp anymore. Like, because I'd been limping because of tendonitis, but I was just like, you need to switch off those signals from your leg to your brain. It's just like nerve signals. You can override that. And so literally, I was actively thinking that. But I was also really acutely aware that one error was going to cost me it. Like, it was I had no time to make any errors anymore. And there was one point when I almost made an error as well, dropping into kind of this point where you have to drop into the right drawer, as they call it, to find the book. And I didn't, I had dropped into the wrong drawer, and the next one I found it on. But if it had been another one, I wouldn't have made it. Yeah, super exciting. And I got up to the fire tower, and I think at that point, the people that were there, again, were written off my chances. But I think you can see even from the video, I was really on a roll, like going, I was getting to the finish. And in my head, I was like, there was no doubt about it, I was going to make it. And so I had it all, the splits calculated to the minute pretty much of when I needed to be on the tops and when I could get into the valley. And actually in every valley, I dipped myself into a stream. I just like dipped completely in underneath the water and then came back out again, because I've always found that really helps to like rejuvenate me. Like I just feel like I can go much more quickly again. So I think it saved me a few minutes on each climb, and in terms of what it cost me, maybe 10 seconds, because I didn't take anything off. I just got fully in and out again. I guess I took off my pack because I didn't want my pages to get wet, but everything else I kept on. Yeah, and then the final descent from the final summit, I was really pushing the whole time. At one point, I tripped and I flew headlong into a bank of leaves, and I was just really aware of how if I'd gone into a tree, it would have been totally other story. If I'd gone off the other side and gone down the bank, it would have been a problem. But I went into the kind of good side. But that final descent went on forever, and the minutes were ticking away, and suddenly I was like, I'm really not sure anymore that it's going to be possible. And I got to the flat bit at the bottom, and suddenly I was like, I've got a kilometre and I've got like minutes to do it, and I'm desperate to stop. And yeah, that final kind of climb up to the gate was so intense and so wonderful in the terms of the support that there was on each side. And it was like, it felt like thousands of people, not just maybe 100 people that were actually gathered there, but it felt really incredible. But at the same time, for me, it was all just about getting to the gate, and everything in me was screaming, stop, you need to breathe. And I was just like overriding all those signals and almost telling my body, if you can't run this pace, then run faster. So I was like, just sprint and you'll get there faster. And all the time in the back of my mind was this idea at that point that you might finish seconds over and it'd be like a Gary Robbins story again, and you'll have to do it all over again. And yeah, it was all about just getting to the gate. And you can see from the videos, because I got to the gate and just pretty much fell over it because I had no control of myself anymore. It was just like I was getting to the gate and I hadn't really, no energy had even gone into the calculation of how to decelerate or touch the gate and sit down in a kind of normal fashion. I just like hit it and basically fell over. So that can shows how spent I was. I honestly left it all out there in a way that I've never done before for anything else race-wise.
Yeah, there was nothing left in the gas tank. The images of you after touching the gate, iconic. You're just collapsed and nothing left at all. Now, I've talked to a number of people who actually witnessed this firsthand, and they said the moment that they saw you in the distance, and then that final stretch to the gate was just absolutely electric. The emotion in the crowd cheering you on was just incredible.
Yeah, I got that impression. After, there's lots of people crying and stuff, people telling me they've been crying. And yeah, it was an incredible moment. Once I'd had time to breathe and look around and realize what had happened, take it in.
Yeah, I imagine you probably didn't take that in as you were doing everything you could just to get to the gate. I think everything else was probably just a blur in the background.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And then, but then once I could sit up, I think one of the first things I said, if not the first thing, was like, thank you. And I was really aware of how much their support made a difference. I kind of, it felt like it was like everybody collectively had been willing me on to the end. And I carried that with me as I was going around that final loop and up that final stretch. It was like, it was almost like they, like their efforts helped to carry me along to the gate and get me there in time with just a second to spare.
Congratulations. And did I hear you say that your body was screaming stop? And so you said to yourself, if I just run faster, it'll be over quicker. So just run faster.
Yeah.
That's a superhuman skill right there. That's unbelievable. All right. Hey, before we wrap things up, do you want to devote any time to the Green Runners?
Oh yeah, I'd love to quickly mention, yes. I don't know, people probably know, I was actually wearing a fairly patched kit when I was out there, borrowed bag, patched my shoes a bit before I went. And part of the reason for that is that I'm trying not to buy lots of new kit, I'm trying to reuse, repair kit. And that's as I'm one of the co-founders of a group of runners called the Green Runners. It's separate to the club that I run for as a kind of the hill running club. But basically, this is like a movement. The aim is to empower and inform runners to make more environmentally friendly decisions that benefit the planet and lessen the kind of impact of us as runners on the environment. So it's based around four pillars: how you move, how you eat, how you kit up, and how you speak out. And there's more information at thegreenrunners.com, and the kind of premise is that you make a pledge and importantly you follow that pledge and carry out those actions to benefit the environment. And then you're a member, you just, I think there's a small fee to join, but the big important thing is making the pledge and then following that and acting it out and doing your best, yeah, to try and reduce our impact as runners and spread the message and kind of act collectively to try and do what we can in the face of the climate crisis.
So important. We only have one planet. So thank you so much for all you're doing to raise awareness in that area as well. All right. Hey, we are finished. I want to thank you for coming on the podcast, Jasmine. We wish you the very best in your future adventures. And we'll hope maybe you'll come back at some point to share some more stories, maybe about the Barkley or about other endeavors that you are involved in. As we close up today, any shout outs to friends or family?
Just as really to say thank you so much to my family, especially my parents who looked after the kids when I was away, when we were away, and to my husband who's crewed me all the Barclays I've been at, and without whom, like, I couldn't have done it. So he's my rocks. Thanks so much to them.
Nice. All right. Hey, thank you for tuning in, everybody. Always remember, the trail is the trail. It doesn't care if you want to go downhill. It doesn't care if it's almost dark and you're looking for a campsite. The trail is the trail. Embrace the suck.